Welcome to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Each episode, LRB Health's Keith Viglioli will talk to the healthcare insiders who are helping to fundamentally transform our healthcare industry.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi. Welcome back to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders, here with our old pal and host, Keith Viglioli. Hello, Keith.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, given the current environment?
Yeah, we don't want to date these podcasts because we know people will listen to them forever and ever, but we are in the midst of Corona Gates 2020, whatever you want to call it. And I know we're both dealing with some cancellations and trying to figure out what the next couple of months will look like. So it's an interesting time to be in healthcare.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a trying time. And obviously, given a lot of people that we work with day in, day out, and our strategic partners, you know, we just wish everybody the best as they prepare for hopefully the management of all this, as every day seems to open up a different vector on it.
That's the thing. I mean, and this is the time where I think we all need to sort of pull together, and not to be cliche about it, but to really treat each other with understanding, because no one really knows what's going on.
Completely agree. And I think that's the part that's, you know, not only spooked a lot of our folks, but obviously spooked the markets and a number of other things, because people really just don't know.
Yep. We'll sure to be talking about it in next month's episode, I hope, in the past tense, looking in the rearview mirror, but we'll see. But it's interesting, and I don't think you timed it this way, but your guest today, Kate Walsh of the Boston Medical Center, CEO of Boston Medical Center, is really an appropriate guest for this time, not only because they really deal directly with the most vulnerable population in my hometown, but also because they have some work in the coronavirus side as well. So how did you happen to time this interview to now? Are you that much of a savant that you were able to foresee this happening?
No, I wish I was that good. But I you know, to your point about Kate, I mean, there could not be a better guest in general, in a broader way to that end. And for folks that are going to listen, right at the tail end, we get into a little bit of back and forth about the coronavirus. And this interview was actually recorded a handful of weeks ago, where we started to see the uptick of the virus in various communities across the world. And we had contemplated whether we would talk through the entire interview about Corona. I made the decision in the beginning, because of Kate's broad experience and what we really wanted to get to, we'd make it a sub part of the interview. So I hope people listen to the end and hear some of that, because Kate's got some wise wisdom around this. They also run on their campus one of the largest biocontainment labs in the country for outbreaks that look and feel a little bit like this. So she's definitely an expert. Boston Medical Centers as a campus are experts in terms of thinking through the right things to do here from a public health standpoint.
Absolutely. And their focus on the Medicaid population is one that we don't talk hardly about, and we really should be addressing, I think, more time to it.
Yeah, and that was an important part of this for me, which is I wanted to make sure we started getting voice of the leaders that are part of the safety net institutions around this country, which a lot of people don't fully understand what a safety net healthcare system is in their community. And so it was an important voice for people to hear, and more importantly, in the beginning, to have Kate to try to talk a little bit about what they do day in, day out, and how, more importantly, they make ends meet to ensure, from a full access standpoint, and ability to provide care into some of these more vulnerable communities and in a lot of times, a lot of our urban areas, but also in a lot of our more rural areas as well.
Excellent. Well, it's a great interview, and I think we should get right to it. So let's start this conversation with Kate Walsh, the president and CEO of Boston Medical Center.
Okay. Well, I'm sitting here in Boston. Again, I have the luxury of not traveling for this one again. And I'm sitting across from Kate Walsh, the president and CEO of Boston Medical Center. Kate, welcome to the Healthcare is Hard podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I'm excited for this one. As we were saying in our preamble, we have yet to sit down with someone who runs a safety net institution. And BMC is squarely that in our great city of Boston. So I'm really excited. And again, I think this is another one of those topics, because you've been around for a long time in the healthcare space, that we probably could run for 2 hours on this discussion, but I'm going to try to keep us sort of to our normal 30 to 40 minutes. But before we get started, as I always start these, as I go into everyone, I really would just like to understand, you know, a little bit more about you. I think a lot of people know you, but maybe some people don't know how you even got here into this healthcare space, this crazy world that we call healthcare.
Sure. Thanks, Keith. It's definitely a crazy world. So I got interested in healthcare kind of through the back door. I was an urban studies major as an undergraduate and had a grant to spend a summer in an urban agency of my choice. And by a series of just dumb luck, I ended up, somebody said, you should look at the Mass League of Neighborhood Health Centers. So I went to the Mass League of Neighborhood Health Centers on my bicycle, and they said, well, you should probably go to this health center, and sent me to Brookside, which is a health center in Jamaica Plain, which was convenient because I could bicycle there from my home in Brookline. And I just fell in love with healthcare, and I fell in love with health centers. It was a Model Cities health center. So this is 1975. So we're like way back. And it was largely run by women, advanced practice nurses. And I really thought, this is the first time I'd seen women in the workforce. You know, my mom worked plenty hard. There were five of us, but she worked, did not work outside the home. And I just fell in love with healthcare and thought when I grew up, I wanted to run a neighborhood health center. And I kind of run a really big one now.
Yeah, I would say so. And so that's a really interesting way in. And you have had stints in New York. Mm-hmm. You've had stints at other systems here in Boston. Yep. How has that transition been? Sort of what's been similar and what's been very different here at BMC?
I think the theme has always been, every place I've been has been a place that's very rooted in academic excellence. They've all been big academic medical centers. They've all had residency programs and research programs. And I find myself very much attracted to an organization that has multiple missions that need to be both juggled and brought forward at the same time. And I think the energy that comes from being on a campus where every July 700 fresh-faced interns and residents come to try to change the world has really been just a wonderful part of my career.
That's really interesting. And so maybe we'll start a little bit also about Boston Medical Center, and maybe start with, I think some people who listen to the podcast maybe not even know what a safety net is.
Sure.
And so start maybe there and then talk a little bit about sort of the communities you serve and the orientation of the campus that you manage.
Sure. So I'm very proud to serve as the CEO of Boston Medical Center. We are a full service academic medical center that can pretty much take care of everything that ails you. What's different about us from the other great academic medical centers right here in Boston is that we disproportionately serve low-income patients. So 50% of our patients live at or below the federal poverty limit, which is about an income of $20,000 or less for a family of three. 70% of our patients are people of color. A third of our medical encounters need translator assistance of some kind. So it's a very big, diverse place. What's pretty interesting is that we kind of have one payer, Medicaid. Right. So I think about our health system, which is our academic medical center, a network of community health centers that we're privileged to work with, a faculty practice plan. We are the primary teaching affiliate of the Boston University School of Medicine. And we also own and operate a Medicaid insurance plan, Boston Medical Center Health Net Plan, that provides peace of mind and access to health care to over 400,000 people across Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Yeah. So you have all the pieces of the healthcare system here. It's a wonderfully diverse and interesting campus, and there's kind of one payer, it's Medicaid. So as I think about healthcare access in this country, I think we can really be part of developing solutions that I think the Commonwealth of Massachusetts needs and the whole country needs, because people need to have access to healthcare. If we believe it's a right, we have to produce that service at a price point the country can afford.
And that challenge, again, I think a subtlety on some of this is, you know, if you're spending the lion's share of your population at Medicaid rates and Medicaid vehicles, some obviously a lot of risk, how do you think about making ends meet in a campus as sophisticated as this? Because I remember when you got appointed, you know, there was some serious financial challenges at this organization.
And there always are, and there always will be. I think that's our lot in life. I think that is really the challenge. The challenge is, how can we deliver the kind of health care you'd want for yourself or for your family in a way that is humane and effective, that encompasses all of the challenges that our patients face, and spends the Medicaid dollar really wisely? And that leads us pretty quickly into thinking about what is now broadly known as the social determinants of health. So for 15 years before I got here, this campus has had a therapeutic food pantry. If a patient identifies food insecurity, our physicians and nurses can give that patient a prescription for food just like they would give a prescription for insulin. And so it's pretty hard to address somebody's diabetes if you just give them the insulin and don't give them the healthy food. So that approach we've taken, we think, and you can think about that across a host of social determinants, and that's one of the ways that we try to make ends meet, not only for our organization, but also for our patients, because they cannot prioritize their health if they're trying to decide, do I fill this prescription or do I pay my utility bill?
Right. I actually saw an article interesting to bring up the utility bill this morning.
Yes.
From Karen Lasser. Yeah, here. Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting article. Yeah. So we do something called a Thrive Screener, where we've asked 57,000 unique patients 8 questions about the social determinants of health. Do you ever worry about making ends meet so that you can buy food? Do you have food for tonight? Do you have a place to live? Are you worried about paying your rent? Do you have trouble getting to your medical appointments? Are you worried about your utilities being shut off? Can you get medicine? Are you taking care of someone in your home? And are you struggling with substance use disorder? I think I've messed up the questions, but those are the themes. So the utility question pops about 7% of the time. But actually, Karen Lasser's research would suggest that our patients are struggling with utility security, if you will, far more than what they report to us. Even in a place where we try to ask the questions in humane and effective ways, in your native language, it's asked by somebody who looks like you. It's an interesting question. So we're learning the limits of our ability to actually address social determinants as a big and complicated healthcare provider.
Yeah, and we, as we said in the preamble when we were talking before we started recording, was we dove into this topic a few times. We dove into it in whole person care point of view from Dr. Penny Wheeler at Allina. We spent a lot of time with Karen DeSalvo on this topic through a whole episode. And, you know, we've also, on the investing side for what we do for a living, you know, we've spent 2+ years unpacking the social determinants market because that's been the place that a lot of private equity and venture capital in partnership with you all trying to figure out what that is. And there's been some massive companies funded. Now, I think the question back to you, back to even that study is, how effective is that screening? I mean, you've been doing it, I think you probably have one of the better lenses, and most of the safety nets do probably around this country, because you've been doing it, the comment you made was 15 years.
Yeah.
Some folks are just sort of putting the screening places in place, or some folks, even Penny, they picked up a CMMI grant to sort of fund what they were doing on that front. I think the last stat was maybe 20% of the institutions in this country do screening. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about that in terms of the effectiveness of what you do? And then,
yeah, I think that you're on a really important question for our industry. And I think about it in sort of 3 ways. The first is we do lots of really complicated things to people when they're at their most vulnerable, and we have to do that perfectly. So if you're a safety net hospital, a full service academic medical center, if you're taking care of people's health and their lives and they entrust that in you, you have to really execute on that. That has to be job one. The second piece of it is the more you understand about our patients' lives and the more they're able to tell us about their lives, we realize that some of the things that impede their health happen outside the walls of our organization. So how do we address that? The third problem is, where do our responsibilities begin and end? And I think that it's been a very unusual situation for Boston Medical Center. You pointed out that we have had our share of financial challenges, although we continue to work really hard to be as effective and efficient a provider as we can. We find ourselves often in conversations with community providers where, like, we're the rich uncle. And that's a very unusual circumstance for our organization, because there's a whole host of organizations outside who are trying to address these problems and don't have the, if you will, the healthcare industrial complex funding behind it that even we have. And so how we do this work, how we engage communities, and how we think about getting people healthy and keep them well is really a challenge. And one of the things is that we've been really excited about is we received an $89 million grant from NIDA, the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, where the goal of that grant is to reduce overdose deaths in 16 communities by 40% over the next 3 years. That's a very hairy, audacious goal. And we were very pleased to receive this very large federal grant. One of many interesting features of this grant is that the unit of measure is the community. So it's not measuring patients. It's whether the community has experienced a reduction in overdose deaths. I mean, it's sort of splitting hairs, but it's really, I think, an acknowledgement of the fact that it is a multifactorial problem that we're trying to solve, and that we need multidisciplinary ways to solve it, and not just thinking about it from the standpoint of medical care during an overdose, which is a very different set of circumstances. And I think that work kind of keeps you humble as an academic medical center.
Yeah, and that's, like, you know, to your point of it reminds me of a Rubik's Cube, right? You're switching so many things on or off to try to figure out what the ideal balance is. But the thing that I keep scratching, and I have so many topics on this one, but the things that I keep scratching my head on this is, you know, we're just now trying to get the health systems into a digital place and a social system place by which they can use some of that. Then you look into the community by which we're touching, and they're way back, not only for capital, to your point, and infrastructure, but all their infrastructure, they're all analog in nature. And the question is how does that balance work? There's many vectors off that. which includes something I really want to talk about in a bit, which is like housing, like everybody, including you all. I think people are now piling into how do we provide housing on this front. Mm-hmm. And so like, I don't know what you think about both those things, but there's probably 200 questions I have in terms of how do you balance that to your point about, I think your third point is the one that's so stuck in my head is where do you start and where do you stop?
Right. And I think that at Boston Medical Center, one of the strengths of being an academic medical center is that you need to be led by the evidence. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've, so that the concerns and challenges, like the Karen Lasser study, will help us think more comprehensively and thoughtfully about our Thrive screener and how we ask questions. We will get better because of the research she did. And I think that these are hard problems. And I think that we need to approach them like we approach cancer or heart disease. Right. We need to do research. We need to understand the problem. We need to ask the questions. We need to gather the data. We need to glean the insights, and we need to change our practice. And whether it's about a disease or whether it's about a social problem, the same process exists. And that's why I am pretty bullish about working at a place like Boston Medical Center that attracts young people who want to save the world, who ask those questions and do that work.
So do you effectively, I haven't thought about this until you start bringing this up, which is do you and the other safety net institutions around the country effectively become the thought leaders here and the research partners here for the better part of the rest of the healthcare community?
I'd like to think that this is, I mean, questions can be asked and answered anywhere, and we reference the fact that we have a lot of information. The signal-to-noise ratio in that information is something we need to spend a lot of time on, but I do think that there are insights that are specifically unique to a place like ours. It's almost like the bench-to-bedside translation. We're at the bedside, but here the bedside's a community,
right,
or a housing project, or a broader, or a group of patients who are struggling with diseases that are exacerbated by their social conditions.
So let's press on that as part of this, which is you run the busiest ED in New England.
Yeah.
I think it's the 12th busiest in the country, somewhere in that stats. Mm-hmm. And then you think about your campus footprint. How, as a leader of BMC, are you thinking about natively? Because this is the question I ask all CEOs of healthcare systems today, right? So if you think about what the next generation, and we bring this up almost every interview, what the next generation healthcare system looks like, the question I think to you is, what does the next generation safety net institution look like? And how far into the community do you go and how far do you not?
Yeah.
And then back to the ED point, you know, the ED really, like most folks, are trying to sort of disband that a little bit. And it's for a certain sort of acuity level. And then how are you thinking about various other avenues into the community by which you can handle that?
Yeah, so there were like five questions in there. I'll do my best.
I'm getting excited on this one. Okay. I'm sorry.
So, you know, I think that, you know, an emergency room like ours, Boston is a city of 600,000 people. How on God's green earth does our emergency room do 140,000 visits in a year? And MGH is doing over 100,000 visits in a year, and the Brigham's doing 100,000. You know, I think the ED might be a symptom of, probably the biggest symptom of how our healthcare system is broken. That said, when a patient comes into our emergency room, we take the same approach to them that we do in a primary care practice. We recognize that they might be there for a specific medical condition, but there's a broad array of other resources that we need to bring to bear on them. So out of our ED, we have, based on our ED programs, that identify patients struggling with substance use disorder and connect them with a counselor who has peer experience that day, you know, that says, you know, you're here today because you fell down and you need stitches in your head, but if we do a brief interview that says, you know, is this interfering with your life and can we help you?
Right.
And if you want help today, we will get you help today. We make sure that we start people on medication-assisted treatment in our emergency room. We have a specific quality goal in our organization to make sure that that happens. So we take that moment in the ED to be as effective across the range of interventions that we need to make as possible. We're also working to reduce the number of visits that are low acuity ED visits. But remember, in other more suburban or commercial populations, that low acuity ED has been replaced by urgent care centers and minute clinics. They are not springing up in low-income communities because the payer mix is not financially profitable. So everyone says, well, those patients shouldn't be in the emergency room, but where are they going to go?
But I think that's the heart of my five questions, which is, it sounds like you just recently did a campus consolidation. The question becomes is in time, does it become a campus expansion somehow into the community?
I would say that the place that we, as our system, and you're a function of kind of who you are, you know, so the first community health center in our country either started in Boston at Columbia Point for Geiger Gibson Health Center or in Jackson, Mississippi. We kind of slug it out. and we work with 14 community health centers that have extended hours in urgent care in their communities, making sure that our patients, the patients who come from Codman Square, one of the health centers we're privileged to work with, know that urgent care is open and that they did not have to take two buses to get to our ED is one of the things we need to do in partnership with them. So that's one thing. There are other ways to deliver low acuity, urgent or episodic care to people. And the most important thing is connecting them back to a primary care system that works for them. One of our emergency room physicians, Dr. Thea James, who's also our VP of mission, always reminds us to ask why. Why is this patient coming to the emergency room at 11 at night? And often the question is, it's not just because that's when they woke up or their television show is over. It's when they got off work from their second job. So we can point to the parts of the healthcare system that aren't working, and we can point to the way things would be if we were better organized about things, and that all of that is true. But there are some fundamental facts of life that we believe we need to respond to, and we need to be here for our patients when they need us most and intervene as effectively as we can in that moment.
And so just because I live in the innovation space, and there's also not only just on SDOH, but there's been a focus. So Andy Slavitt and team at Town Hall Ventures, you know, a bunch of other people have started spending more time on the underserved privileges and including
City Block.
Right. So that's where I was going to go, which is, you know, we know that team pretty well when they came out of the Google Labs. And so
Their medical director is trained here at Boston Medical Center.
Interesting.
Yeah, and was a family medicine resident here. I should say at the outset, I'm a City Block fangirl.
Okay.
I think it's a really interesting approach. It's basically healthcare, as I understand it, kind of without walls. And they're really trying to disrupt people like me. Yeah. They'd be successful if our ED had 30,000 visits or, right. You know, that's the work that they're trying to do. And I am 100% with them on that journey. I think there's two things that worry me about that. The first is, you know, can they scale up fast enough? And the second is, I used to say, don't bet against biology. There are certain things that are going to happen to people. The healthcare system didn't grow the way it's grown in our country because we're evil people who think that we can drain tons of money from people's pockets. It grew because people had diseases and we could intervene in a way that was effective. Yeah. And the diseases of poverty need the same academic focus, rigor, research, as I said earlier. And what I worry about is that there are limits to what City Block can do independent of, because their patients will go on to develop a malignancy.
Absolutely.
And what you would love to see is that the City Block wraparound services and support gets somebody through that horrible episode of illness, thereby bringing down the disparities that we see in cancer outcomes across this country.
Yeah.
So I think it's a both and. And I think that BMC needs to find either build its version of City Block, and we're attempting to do that across our accountable care organization with our community health center partners, or partner with somebody like them to do this work in a more effective way to improve healthcare outcomes for all. There is an incredible inequity in healthcare outcomes in this country. It's based on zip code, not your genetic code, and we've got to fix that.
And that's actually at the basis, I'm glad you went there, that's the basis of my question, and a lot of we talk to healthcare leaders about, which is if you think about the amount of capital that's pouring into, whether you want to call them disruptors, new care delivery models, whatever have you, and what we just saw with One Medical with their mm-hmm. S1 and mm-hmm. what they're doing with partners here in town, or MGH and Brigham here in town, mm-hmm. get the name right. They spent $100 million on it, so I got to get the name right.
I don't think they've spent it yet.
Oh, okay, we're going to.
You'll get the name right when they're done.
But I think it becomes natural potential partners for you all to extend into the community per se. I think the rubber hits the road, to your point, it's about acuity scaling, but the rubber also hits the road on branding scaling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does the brand extend itself into the community, even at the population that we're talking about? Most of the time, these types of discussion we're having is mostly a commercial type of discussion, but I think this is a really relevant chat about that.
Yeah, I think brand's a really interesting question, and our mission is to provide exceptional care without exception. A couple years back, we tested it with patients, and they said, wow, what a great mission for a hospital. I'm so glad that a hospital like that is here for patients who need it. never connecting that they were those patients. It was just it was not a call to action to come to that hospital. They were just glad it was there for somebody. It's right. Kind of an interesting. So Brand's an interesting question, which is probably something you need somebody more skilled than me to talk about.
We can move on from it. I just think it's a really interesting topic over the time, which it hits at the heart of what you were saying, which is there needs to be a support system of communities and populations like this. And there also needs to be a trusted partner in that community.
And we need to trust our patients more.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that where we have failed our patients is agency. We don't expect enough of them. We need to find a way to get the patient's voice much more into our work. And I know we all try, and you know we kind of renew our vows on it every year, and everybody's got a patient family advisory council, but particularly for a problem as complicated as poverty, which is what we're trying to solve here, those solutions don't come from an ivory tower. They come from the people who actually, when we do this Thrive screen, we ask about education and employment. Those are the two things that pop the most. 26% of the people screen in positive for a social determinant. And the one that pops the most is that, do you need help with education or do you need help with employment? No secret on how to be successful in this country in the year 2020. It is, you need a good job, you need a good education, and that's what you want for yourself or your family.
Interesting. It's the first time I've heard it that way, which is we need to trust our patients more. And I think it's great. It's an interesting sort of dynamic, especially when you start thinking about, again, tapping back into the innovation a little bit, about the digitization of a lot of things. And you think about engagement and you think about what they need to be doing on their own to that end. Maybe one topic, and then I'll probably switch subjects a little bit, but or maybe two on this, back to the SDOH. The food is medicine or the food insecurity side of this. You said you've been doing that. Can you explain that a little bit more? It's been a hot topic for us, and we actually just recently made an investment in this space, actually. But I'd be curious from a health system leader standpoint who's been doing it for a long time, and obviously Geisinger's been doing this and a few others have been doing this as of late, but how that works here?
So it's a very simple concept. If people are hungry, give them food. And it started, like most things do, with a good idea our physicians had. So my predecessor realized that, Elaine Ullian, realized that our pediatricians basically were like stocking the cabinets above their desk with food. You know, you'd open a cabinet and canned peaches would fall down on the pediatrician's head. And she thought, well, can't we just get patients food? Can't we just start a small food bank? In America, we have food. What we don't have is always distribution methodology to get that food to patients. So in partnership with the Greater Boston Food Bank,
which is like a mile down the road.
Which is less than a mile down the road. We started a therapeutic food bank. As I said earlier, people write a prescription for food. You get a 3-day emergency supply for your household. So it addresses the kind of hunger we see in this country, which tends to be episodic. Your benefits run out before the end of the month. Somebody loses their job and they're sleeping on your couch. Immigrant and refugee families often bring the food they get from our food pantry to the people they're staying with. They're not working, but they can bring their food. We know if you're hypertensive and need a low-sodium diet. We know if you're getting cancer treatment and you need additional protein in your diet. And having the food prescription written takes away some of the stigma that comes with needing to get food from a food pantry.
And does that work right into your clinical flow?
Yes. You get a prescription. It's in your electronic health record that the prescription is written, we know what you're allergic to, and we know that you picked up the food, which is equally important.
So it
helps the physician can say, I see you didn't pick this up. For some of our frail elders, we let their grandkids pick up the food.
Right.
But in general, you need to be a BMC patient because we're connecting food as medicine. It's part of health. There's no junk food. And we do this in partnership with the Greater Boston Food Bank. And so we started off thinking we would serve 500 families with children. We serve 7,000 families a month, and it's every 2 weeks. People can come by and pick up this 3-day emergency supply of food, which the guys who run the food bank will tell you can kind of stretch for the week. It really does, because we serve the household. And it's balanced meals. It's good. It's healthy food. You know, if you go to a food pantry in the neighborhood, it could be like cornflakes day, and that's kind of all they have.
Yeah.
Because of our partnership with the food bank, are able to give people healthy, nutritious food.
It's interesting on this topic, just because I've spent a lot of time on it, and then we could change subjects a little. You know, there's some incredible stuff that you guys are doing here. There's a great organization, which you probably know, called Community Servings this town.
So we think of it kind of as a food pyramid. You know, there's the, I guess it's not the FDA's version of the food pyramid, but if you need food today, we'll get you food. The next level up is if you live in an area where there's food desert, so a company like Fresh Trucks can go to your neighborhood. A lot of our health centers have Fresh Trucks outside so that you can get fresh fruits and vegetables. And then what Community Servings does is it's medically tailored meals to help people get healthy and stay well. And that is sort of like the people who have the most acute nutritional needs. They are the sickest. They're the top of the pyramid.
Got it.
And it is a spectacular organization.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I've just gotten to know the CEO and them for the last 2 years, and it's been wonderful. So maybe one quick last topic on this, and I'm going to switch back to you a little bit, is the housing stuff. I'm still befuddled on this topic.
Yeah.
And I would love to sort of get your insight about, you know, Kaiser just spent a significant amount of money on this. Mm-hmm. Two or three other health systems just spent a significant
amount. A significant amount of money on this. So a couple of years ago when we did our campus consolidation, which you alluded to, in Massachusetts is a determination of need process. Through the determination of need process, you need to spend a certain percentage of the cost of the project on public health or community-based efforts. Our DON payments, we said, look, we really want to direct this towards housing. So we put $6.5 million into sort of five housing experiments.
Wow.
And so some have been just basic unit rehabs, putting grab bars in Boston Public Health Housing Authority units so that people could safely transition home, redoing what would be sort of housing stock that had fallen on bad times that the neighbors were concerned about, that were people who needed some assistance in being successful in their housing. The one I'm most interested in going back to the food is there's a mixed-use development in Dudley Station. It's called Bartlett Station. It used to be a bus depot where like buses would sit and idle. So it's now mixed-use housing. And what BMC did is we partnered with a company called Good Food, which is out of Washington, D.C., which is a grocery store chain that uses a neighborhood employment model and brings healthy food to a community. They couldn't expand in this market without some capital, so we gave them a no-interest loan of $1 million. So Good Foods will open at the base. You can see the space. It's the housing units are done and the grocery store is being completed.
Wow.
So that what was a food desert will now have a healthy grocery store. We have these five experiments. Then we've partnered with Boston Children's and Brigham and Women's to expand this housing trust through some projects that they're doing there. And the challenge really is, you know, we thought, well, we'll make investments in housing and then we'll have units for our patients and everything will be great. And what we realized is that the housing world is as complicated and maybe as hard as healthcare.
Yeah.
And so the whole voucher system, Section 8 vouchers, you know, there are Section 8 vouchers that work for people who need specific medical needs, but you have to have services in the building. And it's almost like a whole new alphabet soup that you need to understand and I guess eat at some point. And so we've been really trying to think about, again, who do we partner with? How do we do this work well? I sort of joked that the last person you want building beds is a healthcare executive.
Right.
We can't do it for less than $1 million
a
bed.
It's not efficient.
And so we've got to find somebody. Yeah. We've got to find partners who know this space well. And then we've got to find the places where a housing investment helps a patient. Jesse Gaeta, who's the medical director of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, said to me once, you know, Kate, it's more than just a key.
Yeah.
We have to understand how people fell into homelessness and what programs and services we need to help them get out of it. So it's been an interesting and, I keep using this word, but humbling journey for all of us here at BMC.
And my reaction, and then I lied, I want one more subject before I go to a personal question, is it's interesting, you know, when people start talking about health systems as platforms, as we've discussed in previous episodes. So your platform, given the position you sit in the community, gets really, it's not a service. I mean, yes, you have service lines to manage, but you have very different emerging areas of influence and activity that, to your point, you either have expertise or you don't have expertise on that potentially are become extensions of your platform.
And I would say it's both and, because as I said at the outset, we also have to fix your hip when you fall down and break it.
Right.
And we have to do that perfectly. And Medicare gives us the same star ratings as they give Mass General.
Yeah.
And well, actually, they're 5-star. We're 4-star, but we're ambitious. And I think that as the CEO, and I think our board's been really helpful with this, is where do our responsibilities begin and end question is really, that really is, you know, you can get way over your skis trying to fix really hard problems and lose focus on what's actually really important. Patients trust us with their lives. And that's why we're here. That's job one. And you have to, so that people always want to talk about the social determinants of health because it's really interesting.
Yeah.
But the work of the work is making sure we're the best possible hospital we can be, the best possible place to work in healthcare. There's a lot of competition for talent, and the best possible place to create the innovations that our patients need in their lives.
That's a great point. And so I'd be remiss, and I think we'd be remiss not to talk about this. I was going to start in the beginning, but we just got on a roll. But the coronavirus, I mean, given what's going on, you know, we're taping in a day that's the third straight day of the Dow, I think, down by another 1,000 points today. We're in an interesting environment I haven't really talked to anybody yet about sort of how health systems think about being prepared for what may never happen, or, you know, we may see happen in a big way in the Boston community or various communities. You know, Ebola, we saw some breakouts in a couple of different states. So I'm just curious how you think about that as a leader of the organization, how much goes into that as of late over the last, you know, week or two and whatever have you.
So I guess I'd answer that on a couple of levels. I think the first thing that has guided our work at Boston Medical Center, and you see it in our sustainability work, for example, is really being here for the community we serve. And if you look at natural disasters or, you know, challenges, low-income communities are hit harder and recover slower. So some of the investments we've made, you know, if there were a Superstorm Sandy in Boston, we have the ability to be an energy island and would not only support us, but it would support the Boston Commission, Boston Public Health Commission, and Boston EMS, again, facing the community we serve. How that relates to Corona is we are so, and we are always ready. I mean, as a healthcare system, we always drill, you know, disaster preparedness, you know, from everything from active shooters to a pathogen that escaped from the level 4 lab that we have right down the street. And we have a special pathogens unit. The staff there are very highly trained and skilled in all aspects of that care, including protecting themselves during this, which, you know, one of the most important things we need to do as a healthcare provider is make sure our staff are protected so that they can take care of patients. And then finally, it's dealing with the concern of the community, the worried well, the people who think they need to have a mask because they saw somebody wearing one on TV.
Right.
That's the work we do every day. And I would point to, I think, coronavirus as an analog is probably closest to what we saw with H1N1, where there was a lot of concern. There were a lot of people who were quite ill. We didn't quite know how the virus was going to behave over time. It kind of now has become a strain of seasonal flu. I think that's what people think will happen with corona. But the worldwide concern about it, it's very sobering to see how quickly and how easily these diseases can be transmitted. And it really speaks to the importance of thinking about public health, not just the episode of illness. And if you look at where dollars are put in this country, there's a lot more money put on the episode of illness rather than maintaining the public's health. And so I think that this is probably the biggest challenge that we face in terms of where do we put our resources. And it, you see it, you know, think about things as issues as disparate as pharmaceutical pricing to the social determinants issues we were talking about earlier.
But end of the day, it's funny because you, in these times, I think people lose focus to your point about what, you know, your job is and this organization's job is, which is it's tying up with the city of public health, but it's about the public health.
Right.
That's what we're doing here. And yes, it's episodic, but sometimes it's not. And you get in these situations. And I guess the last question on this front is, you know, in the Boston community, are we at the level yet of preparedness, or everybody just expects it, or are we starting to coordinate even between the various health systems?
So the Boston Public Health Commission and the Massachusetts Department of Public Health have been coordinating for weeks, if not months. So I can't remember when the first calls or indications of this were, but we've gotten regular updates. You know, the mayor and the governor and their teams have been on this. There's a very good pre-hospital system here in the city of Boston. There's a very good connection through all the emergency preparedness, the emergency management experts who are expert in our town, and they are international experts in many cases who are, you know, they're the people you see on CNN. And so I think we are really, Boston is really well positioned. I also think that George Daly, who's the dean of Harvard Medical School, pulled together, you know, their hospital system, their researchers, and said, okay, like, there's a lot of smart people here. Can we figure this out? The life science and biotech community are sharing information across in ways that they don't typically do because they compete. So I really am, I mean, I tend to be an optimist by nature. It's
kind of based on what I do.
But I really think that the response, particularly here locally, is something we can all be really proud of.
Great. So last question back to you, and then we'll close up, which is through my research, through people that know you well, I mean, you've always been coined as a fast, decisive decision maker. And you think about the environment that we're in, and you think about the disruption cycles that are taking place, let alone the public health activities that we just talked about are going on. Do you think that's just a absolute must-have for the next generation of healthcare leaders across this country?
You know, I think people have different styles. I always tell people don't confuse motion and progress, but I think it's less about how you make decisions. I think the most important part of making decisions is that point I made about including our patients. I think the successful systems are the ones that actually hear what their patients are saying. Everybody points to Kaiser. What has Kaiser done? They've actually figured out how to take care of patients in a way that works for the patient. And specialists who kind of roam the hallway, as opposed to, you know, I don't know if this is true, but you hear that like in primary care practice, they have dermatologists who are just available, or integrating behavioral health, or, you know, when we organize ourselves in a way that serves our patients, we do really well. How you do it and what style you do and whether you laugh or cry during it, I think is less important. But the really important thing is to remember why you're here. And it's to help people get better and stay well. Because if they, it's incredibly trite to say it, but it's really important to your health. You can't do anything if you're if you're not feeling well.
Well, good. Well, Kate, this has been fun. And we could probably go on for another hour. I know we could, because there's a couple things that definitely did not hit hard enough. But I really appreciate your time, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, thanks very much, Keith. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks. Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. If you want to follow Keith Figlioli, he is on LinkedIn. You can find him there, Keith Figlioli. If you want to share this podcast, make sure you copy Keith and myself. We'd love to be part of that conversation. You can find me on LinkedIn as well, Tom Salemi. You can also find me on Twitter at MedTechTom. I am the editorial director of the Device Talks events and podcasts, so look at devicetalks.com if you're interested in the medical device field. That's it, folks. Tune in next time for another great episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders.